Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would happen if the world stopped turning, or at least began to slow its rotation so that the 24 hours of each day stretched to 25, then 48, then finally each period of light and dark lasted for weeks? Karen Thompson Walker's debut novel, The Age of Miracles, poses these questions through the lens of a Southern California girl named Julia, who, as the slowing commences, is also wrapped up in the personal upheaval of early adolescence, juggling changing friendships, first love, and a dawning awareness of trouble in her parents' relationship with the threat to all life as we know it on Earth. The book quickly hit the New York Times bestseller list when it was published last summer and is now available in a paperback edition. Karen Thompson Walker will be in town this week for the Friends of the SMU Library Lunch Series this Thursday, January 24th. You can find a link to more information on the Think page of KERA. Karen, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Start, if you would, by explaining how you grew interested in the idea of an event like the slowing and what possibilities that might present for telling a story of people.
I got the idea from something that really happened. It was back in 2004, the earthquake that caused the tsunami in Indonesia. I remember reading that that earthquake was so powerful that it actually affected the rotation of the Earth. And I sort of remember right where I was when I read that, because I just found that incredibly haunting, you know, that something I had assumed was steady and stable, you know, the predictable rising and setting of the sun every day, the idea that that was actually in flux was sort of horrifying to me, even though it was a small, you know, the change back in 2004 was the result of that change, was that the 24-hour day got shorter by a few microseconds. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, only scientists could measure the difference. But still, it sort of haunted me, and right away I just started to wonder, you know, what would happen if a much larger change in something so fundamental were to take place. So I wrote a short story sort of right away with that, imagining that question. And I had never written anything actually with you know, a speculative or a fantastical element like that. So it was sort of an experiment for me, but it did feel, I've always loved or been drawn to kind of end of the world stories. I think there's just, the stakes are obviously just so high in stories, you know,
yeah.
when everything we know and recognize as ordinary life is, you know, at risk. I think there's something so sort of instantly, not alluring because it's sort of a negative thing, but it feels exciting. You know, what's going to happen, and will the people survive? Will the Earth survive? So, just right away, I felt drawn in by the idea.
Yeah, and you can't help as a reader imagining yourself, like, what would I do? How would I react? How well would I take this? And I wonder if even you, as an author, had to cope with that every time you were writing, you know, a chapter in the novel.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, one reason that I decided to focus on a young girl, and it's a woman telling the story, but she's looking back on her memories of this time when it was so sort of crucial in her own personal life, but obviously also in the history of the Earth from her perspective. One of the reasons I chose that perspective was that I think it made it easier for me to begin to imagine, you know, what if this had happened during my childhood, and now I was telling the story, you know, how would it have changed my childhood? You know, how would I feel about it, you know, 10 years later, as things have gotten worse and worse, you know, in the book. So I think that helped, yeah, imagining sort of an ordinary young girl and an ordinary woman telling the story. It helped me access all those things, because you're right. When I see movies that have an end-of-the-world story, or I read books with that, you immediately start to wonder, well, how would you react and how would your life change?
And there is also, it seems like, in this sort of literature, the sense that it's comforting only to the extent that you think, well, no matter what's going on in the real world right now, nothing is as bad as the Earth stopping, you know, ceasing to turn the way it used to.
Right. I mean, that's actually sort of have a pet theory that one reason that a lot of us are drawn to these kinds of stories is there is that sort of perverse pleasure, you know, it sort of reminds you how extraordinary our ordinary lives are, you know, just the small details of daily life, the sun rising every day and setting every day, and the, just the fact that, that the Earth is set up to, you know, allow human life to exist at all. I think it's books, stories like this, I think, help remind us.
Yeah.
I mean, it helps when I come across other people's books and movies like that. It helps remind me just sort of how extraordinary our ordinary and maybe sometimes boring lives really are.
And, you know, what I really loved about the premise is that the one fact we have all taken for granted for all of human history is that we can count on the sun to rise every morning and set every night. And for me, it drove home the fact that we end up obsessively worrying about things, thinking we can predict what will change our lives. And often the things that change our lives are things that we never imagined happening.
Yeah, no, I definitely was very interested in that idea as I wrote. I mean, I'm very interested in sort of how much uncertainty we all live with, but then all the sort of coping mechanisms we have for thinking of our lives as more certain than they really are. But yeah, it's definitely, it's in the language, you know, the sun, I mean, in our language, the sun rises and the sun also sets, you know, I think it is really fundamental. And I think you're right that to me, the sort of scariest, idea just in life and in books is the idea that something that we never saw coming actually is the thing that as you said radically changes our lives. And it's definitely the case for Julia and her family in this book.
So one of the things that happens here is that the society is essentially divided up into people who decide to go along with the government recommendation to, you know, as it's literally weeks of time in darkness, weeks of time in light. The government says, you know what, let's just all pretend that we're still on a 24-hour clock and live that way. And then there are other people who decide to follow the rhythms of nature to the extent possible, and there forms this division. Can you talk about how that came into your mind and how it plays into the story?
Yeah, I mean, I tried to write this story sort of, I wrote it in chronological order, so I was, you know, figuring out each development as I got to that point in the story. And it seemed, so as soon as I slowed down the rotation of the Earth, it was clear that the 24-hour clocks would no longer correspond to the natural periods of daylight and darkness. So, and then as soon as I realized that, I thought, well, eventually, I think it seemed, it just seemed realistic that the government would, because it was try to do something against all that chaos, you know, and they would impose this 24-hour clock. So everyone goes back to the clocks, as you said. But as soon as I made that decision, it seemed I just knew that there would be some people who would refuse to, you know, that would seem too artificial to live by a 24-hour clock, because it starts to mean that, you know, midnight strikes in daylight and children are going to school in darkness, you know, and every day is different, and it's a sort of a different kind of chaos. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like some people, a minority of people, would naturally refuse to live by that now artificial clock. And so I was very interested in that, in then what would happen once you have these two groups, which I called the clock timers, which is most of society, and the real timers, who are, as you said, interested in, you know, staying in tune with nature, and they try to live by the rising and setting of the sun. And it seemed likely to me that those two groups would come into conflict, and that they wouldn't be able to. They can't coexist in society, because they're just living on completely different, you know, time systems. So, at the same time, I also feel like in any time in history, when there's times when people are when there's a lot of fear in the air, I think people are even more likely to be sort of suspicious of, you know, other groups and people who disagree with them. And so what happens in the book is that the real timers are sort of start to feel increasingly kind of isolated from the rest of society. And they start to form these sort of new communities out in the wilderness and in the desert, so that they can live, you know, in a little community according to their system of time, which they believe to be the healthier one, the more natural one. But even that becomes, it starts to become harder and harder as the days grow longer and longer, because, you know, at a certain point they can adjust their circadian rhythms, adapt surprisingly well. That's something I learned in my research, actually, that human circadian rhythms are adaptable to some extent. But as the days get longer and longer, it becomes more and more impossible. And that just it just reminded me of other kinds of, you know, idealism that sometimes comes into conflict with the practical realities of life.
Yeah, I thought in reading about those two groups, it made me think about the division, which some people think is not necessarily, a foregone conclusion, but the division that exists between the secular world and the religious world, and both having a sense that they are doing things the only way that makes sense to them, and both might, you know, come into conflict at times, and both might miss out on something good that the other has to offer.
Yeah, it's interesting that you raised that. I mean, I think there is definitely an analogy there. And in the book, I some of the people who feel that they need to stay on in tune with the sun on real time are religious people who need to feel the need to maintain sort of the order of every 7 days a Sabbath, mm-hmm. and their definition of the day, you know, is very much tied to the sunrise and sunset. But even separate from that, I do think that religious conflicts or, you know, arguments we have here about, how much we can eat, how much organic food we can, you know, how much we can shift our lives around so that we're eating only organic food versus other, like, economic considerations. You know, there's always, I think it's common that we have these conflicts, especially between groups who... their point of view to govern their entire lives. Mm-hmm. You know, it just makes it so that then you can't really coexist easily with someone who has an opposing vision that also governs their entire life.
And the irony, of course, is that they all share the same ultimate fate, right? They're all cruising through space on the same planet.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it's definitely. Even different countries. The book is, you know, set in California, and it's mostly about an American childhood and how that would be changed. But you know, things are happening, unfolding in slightly different ways in different countries. Even though, of course, you're right. They're all facing the same conundrum.
Did you dream about this scenario as you were writing the book?
You mean like in my? Did I have dreams about it?
Yeah, I mean, did it sort of creep into other aspects of your life outside of your work life?
I think I have definitely had dreams where I'm in my book. I think more often though, I did, you know, because The Age of Miracles is about what if the sunrise and sunset were not so predictable. I mean, that is sort of the most fundamental question, mm-hmm. that made it so that there have been a few times where I've woken up and maybe I woke up earlier than usual and I'm surprised that it's still dark outside. And I think, wait, like for a second, not really, but for a second feel this feeling, you know, what if this is really happening? Especially when I was writing the book.
My guest is author Karen Thompson Walker. Her novel, The Age of Miracles, is now available in paperback, and she's got a visit to Dallas scheduled for later this week. She'll appear at the Friends of the SMU Library Lunch Series this Thursday, January 24th. You can learn more about that on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Karen Thompson Walker. Her new book, The Age of Miracles, is now available in a paperback edition, and she'll be in town on Thursday the 24th for a Friends of the SMU Library Lunch Series event. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Karen, when I was reading this book, and I read it over the summer on vacation at the beach, which is sort of an odd place to read about the end of the world, but I have kids Julia's age, and the one thing that struck me about this, the whole metaphor of the sort of the end of the world and adolescence when nothing seems like it ever has been, is that this is, she's at exactly the age, she's 11 turning 12, at which you start to realize that your parents are mortal and flawed and maybe can't protect you from everything that you once thought. Julia becomes aware that her parents' relationship isn't perfect in a way that maybe she wouldn't have if she were a few years younger. Can you talk a little bit about that, how vulnerable, you know, every young person feels at the point when suddenly they understand the world a little more clearly than they did before?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it's interesting that you I'm interested to know that you have a daughter who is this age. But I do think that's a good kind of definition of adolescence, is that moment when you're still a child, but you're beginning to recognize certain truths about the world, about the adult world. So for Julia, it means detecting problems in her parents' marriage. And seeing that not everyone, adults don't always tell the truth. But I think, and I do think that adolescence is a time when every sort of disappointment feels like the end of the world. You know, because everything is new. This book is it's partly a love story, and so for Julia, you know, sort of having that early sense of love. For another boy at her school, that feels, you know, just sort of tremendously meaningful in a way that, and it is meaningful, but I think it's in a way that we sometimes forget as adults. We start, we look back on that time, and it's hard to remember always how dramatic it feels.
Yeah.
And I think it was interesting to try to concoct a situation in which, because the kids in my book really are the last, I mean, they really might be the last generation to experience some of these ordinary sort of dramas of middle school and of adolescence. It felt to me like a way of writing about them that would give them a little more sort of reverence than we might think of, you know, because we don't know how long these kids, in my book, it's unclear how long they'll be able to live normal lives, and so every bit of normal life, I think it was sort of satisfying to write about it in a way that all those small things would feel important, and as important as they did to me when I was going through them as an actual adolescent.
Well, I'm so glad you brought it up and phrased it that way, because I was going to ask you. I'm going to work very hard to give no spoilers up in this interview. But as you mentioned already, that young adult Julia, is looking back on her own adolescence and describing these events.
Right.
So we know at least that she makes it to recount these events for us.
Right.
But is she more trustworthy as a narrator because of the nature of what she's describing than any of the rest of us would be in sort of unconsciously but selectively recalling what happened to us and what it meant at the time and how it all went down?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. I haven't thought about it from exactly that angle, but it's really interesting. I think it's true that we remember certain kinds of traumatic events. People remember in great detail, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think for her, certainly this year when the earth started to slow down, it seems logical that it would be burned into her memory, and every part of it is burned into her memory. So, you know, as I wrote the book, I wanted her to be sort of a fairly reliable narrator. But of course, these are memories. You know, they're her memories of something that took place, you know, 10 or 12 years earlier. So I think she's still subject to the kind of, to what we all, the kind of sort of I don't know, gauze of memory that we all have when we think back to those times. Mm-hmm. But I think for her, her adolescence might be even more meaningful to her than our own are were to us, because for us in the sort of ordinary world, you know, you grow up and move on, and you're able to see how the things you thought were so important that when you were 11
right.
actually aren't as important as you thought, because you know you have this. This perspective comes with age, and you have all these other experiences. But for Juliet, you know, it's unclear how many more years of life she'll have, and that this time of adolescence struck sort of in the last for her, in the last days, the last months of what we would recognize as ordinary life on planet Earth. So it is. I think there's an extra layer of meaning for her in writing about it.
Karen Thompson-Walker is with us. We're talking about her novel, The Age of Miracles, which is now available in paperback. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here that says, another what if I have had on the end of the world is how relationships would change. Would friends remain friends? While simply getting across town might be perilous after some disaster, I see myself retreating to the farm and then having to decide who I can trust, and it's signed Steve the Paranoid. And this is something, friendships do change in your novel.
It's true. I mean, I think that this kind of, the low level of uncertainty that everyone is living with and fear, it puts extra pressure on all the relationships. For Julia, she loses some of her friends, and it's not in quite the direct way that it's not quite in the way that the emailer mentioned or imagined. But you know, the directions of people's lives are changing, and they start to make different decisions. And Julia's one of her best friends, Hannah. Her family sort of flees. Her family is Mormon, and they decide. That they want to be with their family, the rest of their extended families in Utah. So they, because it might be the end of the world, and so they flee to Utah. And so Julia, you know, loses her best friend for a while, and then it's their friendship is never the same after that. So it certainly puts pressures on the relationships. I mean, in my book, I was very interested in the sort of subtler trajectories and the subtler changes between people. Because this book is really a lot about the sort of gradual changes and gradual descent into a more chaotic version of our lives, as opposed to, you know, a lot of really great apocalyptic stories, you know, on page two, society has already broken down completely and
yeah.
people are, you know, living on a farm with shotguns, you know. I mean, my book is more about our ordinary life kind of gradually being dismantled and changing.
And it's almost worse. I mean, and I should tell people, this is not an unpleasant book to read. It's lyrical and beautiful, and there are really moments of transcendence. But the idea that it's not done yet and you don't quite know how this is all going to shake out, I think adds to that ominous sense of uncertainty.
Yeah, I mean, I was, like I said before, I was very interested in uncertainty. And I was also interested in sort of charting all the sort of shimmer of our real ordinary life as we know it, you know, the world as we know it now, you know, the plants and the animals and birds flying in the sky. And so watching those things change as I wrote the book, change in the book was, it gave me an extra sense of how, just how wonderful all the real things we have in life are.
So talk a little bit about Julia's relationship to her parents. Her mother really kind of loses it pretty early on and is really afraid and copes in whatever way she can, but is not much help, essentially, to her daughter at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it was important to me to try to make this story feel realistic, and one of the things that seemed realistic was that some people would handle this news and this sort of growing uncertainty and fear better than others. And I think one of the ways that some people would handle it, and certainly it is the way that Julia handles it, is kind of an unmanageable level of anxiety and fear and she's just not able to keep up with ordinary life the way that other people react in almost the opposite way, like Julia's father. They're almost in denial, you know, or it seems so important to try to hold on to the order that we, whatever order they can hold on to, you know, whatever kind of consistency they can hold on to and hold on to all the old rituals, that they are almost in denial, whereas Julia's mother obsesses about it and, you know, stockpiles canned goods and water because she's afraid of what will eventually happen, you know, what will happen to society and as the days get longer and longer and, you know, crops are failing and plants and animals are dying. So there's a lot of frightening things happening. But it does definitely affect Julia's relationship with her mother. And I think, you know, I think that time, adolescence, is a time when mothers and daughters, there's a certain amount of potential for conflict anyway, you know, because the children or the daughters, they need to be growing away from their parents and growing away from their mother. But of course, the mothers are not that excited always about that.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, I don't mean to make more of this movie than you meant to be in the book, but the whole idea, that there's that mothers don't quite know how to handle it. They think they've known all along, you know, what's coming, and then it turns out to be a bigger deal than they thought. And even there's a scene where Julia, I think it's her 12th birthday, and so her mom gives her a pair of shoes. And even, you know, the world is ending and, you know, there's chaos. And Julia's like, yeah, everyone else in my class has had these for months. And I just loved it because it was, to me, it felt so real. Like, still, even though, you know, there's chaos, she's still a 12-year-old girl who can kind of roll her eyes at her mom because she got her something that would have been cool a year ago.
Right. Oh, I'm glad that it seemed real to you, the mother of a 12-year-old or 11-year-old daughter. But yeah, I mean, I think those small moments, I mean, it's not like that exact thing comes from my childhood, but I did try to really remember what it was like and what that sort of growing distance can be that happens, I think, just naturally and maybe necessarily, I think, as children are first trying to grow up a little bit.
Yeah. Who did you, when you were writing this book, did you have in mind, like, who the audience would be?
You know, I always try to write... for a reader like me, so you know, I hoped, of course, it would appeal to a wider audience. But I was trying to picture, you know, as I made decisions and about the characters and how to tell the story, I tried to imagine, you know, what if I was reading this book? Would this work for me? You know, that's always my guide. Mm-hmm. But it's been exciting to find out that some younger readers are also interested, and obviously it makes sense since it's so much about, you know, life at age 11. But I figure every adult has been through that age. So
yeah,
I like the idea that it may appeal to both, you know, all ages.
We've come to an interesting time, it seems, in literature where, you know, there's the young adult category, which has sort of been both glorified in the market and then vilified by critics, and yet works are starting to emerge that don't necessarily feel limited in the same way that maybe, and I think you're a little bit younger than I am, but when we were young, we might have read books technically written for adults, but that resonated with us as teenagers. And
right.
Now maybe it can go the other direction as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, in a way, maybe it's circling back because for me, I had the same experience where I read children's books, and then, you know, junior high and high school, I read, there were certain books that were written for adults, but that were really sort of appealing to teenagers or middle school kids. So I do like the idea that now we could circle back and sort of share the literature, you know, between teenagers and adults, and it doesn't have to be such a distinct line about, you know, who's reading what.
I read an interview that you gave somewhere, and you mentioned speaking to a physicist about what might actually happen in a situation like this, and you said that was very daunting, and I wonder why that was the case. I mean, it's not like this physicist would expect you to know exactly everything from a scientific perspective.
Right. Well, I mean, maybe the daunting thing was I wrote this book. I did my own research when I was writing the book. Mm-hmm. And it didn't, I sometimes thought about, you know, talking to a physicist or showing a physicist some of what I was working on, but I just didn't quite have the nerve to bother, you know, like a real scientist with something that I had no idea. You know, I knew how hard it was to publish a book, so I had no idea if this book would ever, you know, be between covers. So I felt I didn't quite have the nerve to bother someone, so I just tried to teach myself as much as I could. And, you know, the book is, I wanted the science to be very realistic, but it's from the perspective of, you know, a memory of a child, memories of a childhood. So I guess I felt I had a certain amount of leeway there, but I wanted the physics to feel real. So after I sold my book, then I worked up the nerve to actually send it to an astrophysicist. Mm-hmm. And so that was why it was daunting, because I had already written the whole book and taught myself what I could and sold it. And so if he had said, oh, none of this makes sense, I mean, I think I still would have felt like that's the beauty of fiction, you know. You have license to anything that you want can happen in the universe of your book, but I was hoping that he wouldn't say that it didn't make sense. So he helped me fix a few. I had misunderstood a few things, and he helped me fix those. But it was really, in the end, it was a really satisfying experience to get to know him a little bit and hear his thoughts. And he was a perfect reader for me, because he was a real lover of fiction as well as an astrophysicist.
We are speaking this hour with author Karen Thompson Walker. Her New York Times bestselling novel, The Age of Miracles, is now available in a paperback edition, and she will be in town this week for the Friends of the SMU Library Lunch Series. That event takes place on Thursday, January 24th. You can find a link to more information on the KERA Think page. If you'd like to join the conversation, maybe talk about your experience with this novel or your interest in apocalyptic fiction, or you'd like to ask a question, we would love to have you join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to author Karen Thompson Walker about her novel, The Age of Miracles, which is available now in paperback. She's got an event scheduled for Thursday of this week, January 24th, with the Friends of the SMU Library Lunch Series. Find information on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Andy, who writes, I like to think that the truest evaluation of life skills would be put to the most extreme of tests in such a case as this. For instance, it's probably more important to be able to drive a car with a standard transmission than to put together a really captivating flyer for an upcoming event. Or is it? What do you think about that, Karen?
I mean, I think that's a great question. Of course, as an artist, I'm inclined to think, like, you know...
a little both.
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, certainly the practical skills would be very important, but I hate to think that then, you know, art and literature would become irrelevant. I mean, I think, I think a mix of practical skills and hopefully the things that we, practical skills would be important, but also, you know, the things that people take solace from, you know, whether it's religion or art or literature would also gain a new importance, and so would personal relationships. You know, that's the way that I see it. But certainly, you know, Julia's father in the book is a doctor, and she decides, she thinks at a certain point about following in his footsteps, and I think that, you know, that is partly because we will always need doctors.
Yeah, you always wonder, you know, will novelists and, for that matter, journalists be allowed into the bunker, you know,
right,
if something happens? And I'm not sure about that. Talk about this, Karen. The character of Julia's grandfather is really interesting, and it does force you to think about the fact that depending on where you are in the journey of your life, an event like the end of the world would strike you in a really different way.
Yeah, I think that's true. For Julia's grandfather, who is, you know, somewhat based on my own, at least the personality of the grandfather, somewhat based on my own grandfather. But yeah, Julia's grandfather is someone who has lived through a lot of, you know, decades of life and of turmoil, you know, the turmoil of the last few decades of history. So for him, he sort of resurrects his old bomb shelter, which is sort of a Cold War bomb shelter, for this new time, and is very concerned about what's going to happen next, and whether people are prepared for what's going to happen, and about whether Julia and her family are going to be safe and prepared.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that was interesting is so they try to keep life going to the extent possible in the way that it was before, even though, you know, crops are failing and animals are dying, because of course nothing on Earth is evolved to withstand the kinds of conditions that exist now. But the kids are still going to school, and there's a scene where they're assigned, like, their summer reading list, and even the classics, I think they have to read, what is it, Huckleberry Finn, and I can't remember what else. There's two other classic novels, and they start to feel less relevant somehow.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think in my mind, I thought people would be trying to hold on to, all the old ways. Like, somehow, if they can hold on to the old ways and the old books, and just the way things were done in the past, that they could somehow, that will feel as if everything is going to be fine, and that, you know, that they can survive. But that's so interesting that you thought that they began to seem irrelevant. I mean, I think at one point they also read a Ray Bradbury short story.
Oh, right, the one about the people moved to Venus, right?
Right. And it's about a young girl. It's called All Summer in a Day, and it's about a young girl a group of school children who live on Venus, where the sun only comes out once every 7 years. Breaks through the clouds every once every 7 years in Bradbury's imagination of Venus. Mm-hmm. And so that, actually, I had the feeling as I put that in, that a story like that, which is sort of a classic story, has a new relevance in this world, this changed world for these kids who are now living something.
I was thinking about that story even when I began this book, and so it was so interesting to see it referenced there, because it's one of those stories that sort of sticks with you. And in that story, as well as in this one, Julia seems, on the one hand, very observant. She sort of really takes the time to understand things, and that in some ways almost contributes to her social isolation. We have the sense that she is not like the other kids.
Yeah, she's more of she's quieter and kind of a natural observer and a thinker, which were qualities that I thought I think came in handy as a narrator, make her a good narrator. But yeah, it's true. That's a big part of the difference. You know, other kids are not spending that much time thinking about and observing and noticing the small details, or the big details. They're just, you know, acting and living, and more like your sort of average teenagers, yeah, you know, and younger.
I mean, is that what it feels like to be a, you know, 12-year-old novelist to be?
Well, I think, I wouldn't exactly say this book is The Age of Miracles is autobiographical, but I did draw on my own. Certainly Julia has a lot of personality traits that I have and that I had when I was her age. I mean, like her, I was an only child, and yeah, I think I am sort of a natural observer like she is, and her experience of middle school was much more traumatic than mine, but I do remember that feeling of kind of overthinking everything and just feeling quieter than some of the other kids and a little more shy, which is a problem for Julia as well.
But then she finds a kindred spirit in Seth. And it's interesting the way they're drawn together, because we wonder if they would have been drawn together if not for these circumstances.
Oh yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think in general, that's a question that sort of haunts Julia in general. You know, what events in her life would have unfolded in the same way, and which ones wouldn't have if she'd had a normal childhood. You know, how would things have happened? But I think you're right that it raises for Seth and Julia, they're living in this kind of just scary time in a way that raises the stakes on the small things, like raises the stakes on every relationship and every friendship, and they're together, they're experiencing things that they wouldn't have otherwise experienced, and they're bonding over them. Like a couple of whales begin to beach themselves nearby where they live, and Julia and Seth go down to the beach and try to do something for the whales. And that kind of experience, I think, for both of them is very meaningful and intense in a way that, you know, if they were living more ordinary lives in a more ordinary time, maybe they wouldn't have bonded so strongly.
Yeah, and they get a great deal of freedom, which is, I think, something that kids of this age maybe fantasize about. They have a great deal more freedom because, everything's in turmoil. And so they're able to come and go. Maybe not as they please because someone wants them to be in a certain place, but they sort of take liberties that they might not have taken otherwise.
Yeah, that's a good point, and they're not maybe watched as closely.
Yeah.
Because the adults are
freaking out.
Yeah, I mean, even though they're also very worried about their children, but they're also just distracted. The adults are distracted for sure.
If you don't mind, I'd love to talk a little bit about your career because you were employed as an editor. Is that right? Before you actually wrote the novel.
That's right. Well, I started writing the novel when I was in graduate school as a short story, but then I started working in book publishing. So I started as an editorial assistant and kind of slowly worked my way up to an editor position at Simon & Schuster. So while I was working, I was writing this novel in the mornings for sort of most of the time I had those jobs. I would just get up every morning and chip away a little, spend about an hour, and then work again the next day, and so sort of a slowly but surely process.
Is it just incredibly helpful to know how it all works, or does that like ring in your head knowing exactly how works are dismissed or looked at carefully and the way that they are sort of produced as products in the publishing industry?
You know, when I first went from an MFA program where it was all just about the writing and the art, and then I went into this publishing house. And when I first got there, the first sort of few months, it was hard to see how it works in the inside, and just how the main thing for me that was a little discouraging was how hard it is to publish a book. Like how many good books get turned down for one reason or another, and that kind of stuff was a little discouraging. But I think, in general, I really treasure my experience as an editor because once I sort of was able to stop obsessing about that part of it, I also just learned a tremendous amount about writing. You know, working as an editor is like being a professional reader, where it's your job to, you know, point out everything that might bother a reader. You know, what's unclear, what's too slow, what is unconvincing. You know, which characters seem real and which ones don't. And as I learned to do that job, to edit other people's work, I noticed that my own writing became much, much sharper and my own stories, you know, moved more quickly and hopefully characters were more real. And those were skills I was learning, you know, at work as an editor. Mm-hmm. But then I was able to, you know, take home and apply in the mornings to my own work as well.
Did it ever strike you that you are coming of age as a novelist at exactly the time that many people are predicting the imminent demise of the publishing industry?
I think that
I don't know. Let me interrupt. I don't know that I accept that. I think people will still read. They just won't necessarily read paper books.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a time of incredible change. I mean, I think my feeling is, I think people have been predicting the demise of the publishing industry for a while. I remember once when I first started working in book publishing, there was an interview that I read somewhere where someone was saying like they remembered when they started working in book publishing like in the early 60s, and they said everyone was saying like it was over. So I think, I mean, some piece of that has been happening, I think, for a while, and somehow we've persisted. But you're right that there's a lot of really serious changes happening. I mean, I think in terms of changes related to ebooks, I think, are exciting. You know, I think I'm glad that books are not being left behind by sort of the technological revolution. You know, that there's a they're being pulled right along with everything else, and they're, you know, I think some people might be reading more because of ebooks, you know, and because it's easier and
the instant gratification of the download in 2 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I personally, I think I will always love paper books, but I'm happy for people to read. Just if people are reading, that's what makes me happy. So I don't care what form.
So this next question may make you groan, but we've had a couple emails about whether or not there's been a movie optioned.
Oh, well, we optioned the movie rights to a company called River Road, and they did The Tree of Life and Brokeback Mountain, among others. So I'm very excited about that, but I know that, you know, in Hollywood, there's a lot of hurdles to be overcome before anything actually becomes a real movie. So, you know, I'm crossing my fingers. There's a script, and, you know, it seems like things are moving in a good direction, but no news yet as to, you know, when or if it'll be a real movie. But we'll see. I hope so.
I guess that's a leap of faith, too, though, right? That you take this thing that was entirely your creation. Maybe you worked with an editor, but it's your idea, and then suddenly it becomes someone else's vision equally, almost.
Yeah, I mean, I think my feeling is, it is. I think it will be. If it is made, it'll be a sort of an interesting experience for me. But I think my feeling is that it is a separate art, you know, and so it's for example, I was glad to not be involved in, you know, the script or anything like that, because I feel like I already did my take on this idea is in the book, you know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I try to just be excited about seeing someone else's sort of take on the same story, you know.
Is it a blessing and a curse to have an extraordinary success with the very first book that you publish?
Probably so. That's probably true. I mean, I definitely never expected to be in a position where, you know, worrying about that being a curse. Especially because I worked in book publishing, as I said, I just knew how hard it is to have get any kind of attention for a book. So I just feel really glad that the book has, you know, reached a lot of readers. But, you know, I try to, when I sit down to write every day, I'm working on a new book, I try not to think too much about that, because I just don't want to put extra pressure on myself. But
Karen Thompson Walker's novel, The Age of Miracles, is now available in a paperback edition. She will be in town on Thursday, January 24th, for the Friends of the SMU Library Lunch Series. You can find a link to more information on the Think page of KERA.org. Karen, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download the podcast free at KERA.org/think and find more information about upcoming shows. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.